Martin Parr has attempted what many might consider the impossible. He's directed Hamlet with only four actors in a production which takes a mere 90 minutes, at most. Yet it's not a spoof or a workshop version. It's being performed in a space both iconic and challenging, the remains of the Rose Theatre on Bankside, not far from the reconstructed Globe and almost opposite the site of the Elizabethan original of the Globe. The dark, watery space, imprisoned under an office block, is full of ghosts. Plays by Marlowe, Shakespeare, Jonson and Kidd received their premieres here between 1587 and 1603, although not Hamlet, written about 1599 and probably first seen at the Globe. But the performance space is limited. Well, Martin Parr has braved the demands of the space before with the production of Romeo and Juliet, so he's not dispirited by that. My name's Heather Neal, and Martin Parr has agreed to talk to Theatre Voice about his approach to the text and some of the decisions he had to make about the production. Well, first of all, that space, let's start with that. It's a wonderful space, but it's cold, and the main acting area is a narrow strip to the side of the outlines of the rose, the original rose, which you can see picked out by strings of red lights, which look like beads. Although we don't see these in your production at first. So tell us about the space and how you decided to negotiate it.
I think the first thing to say about the space is that it's so resonant. When you go in there, as you say, there's lots and lots of ghosts. It thrills me every time I go in. So you've got a ready-made atmosphere before you go in. And yes, we've got a hugely decimated cast, but we've got a company of ghosts down there. They're all in the dark listening, I think. When I was asked to direct Hamlet there, my first thought was, how ridiculous, because it's, in my mind, always been such an epic piece. And then my second thought was, well, how exciting to reclaim it from that epicness and to produce something that felt very intimate and I sort of call it a living room Hamlet, so that you have people just talking very simply to you. I suppose, you know, a Cottesloe or Don Bois sort of experience. And that really excited me, because I thought that audiences would hear things in the text that they perhaps haven't heard before, when someone's perhaps marching across the Olivier or the Globe, where there are other factors involved. So the space I find hugely exciting. Yes, there are limitations. It's really cold. I don't want that to put anyone off. There are blankets available. Like you say, we do it quite quickly. It's very mysterious. You've got a lake covering up the old theatre. So, of course, you've got a ready-made set, really, for Ophelia's lake where she is drowned. You've got a sort of crumbling beach surrounding this lake, which is ready-made for the gravedigger. And there's a slight feeling of battlements, I suppose, about the stage, with the barrier looking down onto the lake. So in many ways, you've got a kind of perfect location, really, for the play.
Although you don't allow us to see across the watery covering of the footings of the original theatre for quite some time, do you? It's not till Act Four.
That's right, yes. Well, one of the wonderful things about the Rose is that lots of people come to see the environment, and possibly sometimes, I'm not saying this for everyone, of course, but sometimes the play might be slightly secondary for some people. You get quite a few theatre tourists, which is terrific. But what can happen is that some people, when they enter the space and see that lake and see that beach and see that environment, of course, like lemmings almost, they go towards it and are entranced by it. And it can be quite tricky getting them calmed down to them.
There's a barrier, isn't there? They look over the barrier.
That's right, yeah. So it's a little bit like being on the promenade of a seaside resort, looking down onto a beach. So what we wanted to do was not allow people to do that, slightly selfishly, but to come in and think that they're in a very, very small space and not think about the greater environment, I suppose. And then at one point in the play, which is a very shocking moment in the play, we pull down that barrier and hopefully at the appropriate moment, because you're supposed to be quite shocked at that moment by what's happening in the play, and then you discover the space.
Mm. Yeah, this is when Claudius calls for lights, yeah. When they're watching the play, The Mousetrap, which is giving him away, yeah. or at least confirming his guilt. And when he calls for lights, we see lots of these little beaded red lights, and we see the whole of the space behind the actors. And then you begin to use the space beyond the water, what you call the beach, and that's where Ophelia does her mad scene.
Yeah. We also call it the gloom. It is very gloomy.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. What lighting have you got? It looks very minimal.
Handheld torches, that's all we use.
Yes, for across the water. Yeah. But even the rest of the lighting is very minimal.
Really minimal. It? They're just real lights. They're just two light bulbs that are on a dimmer switch. So, again, that was to do with making it very domestic and making it very chamber piece.
Oh, you're saying that's a choice? That's
very much. Oh, very much, yeah. Yeah, they're not there. They were designed for us. And then when it opens up, we wanted to sort of let hell into the space. So the idea of the beyond and the unknown and the darkness, the gloom, death, hell. There's a sort of feeling of the river Styx down there as well. So when that's opened up, it is everything that happens to do with death or the unknown continues down in that space.
Mm. Well, the text, I mean... How on earth did you set about this? I mean, obviously, you know, Hamlet's notorious, isn't it? Because there are three texts anyway. There are three versions, the two quarto versions and the folio. Most people go for the folio with bits of the second quarto. But the first quarto was perhaps, well, might have been used for touring, but it was certainly remembered probably by an actor, wasn't it? So you didn't use that much at all, did you?
From the first folio?
Yeah.
No,
the first quarter.
What we started with actually was I'm very heavily involved with a company called Actors from the London Stage, which is a group that takes Shakespeare to America twice a year, and it was set up by Patrick Stewart about 40 years ago. It came out of the RSC, and they set up touring Shakespeare plays with five actors only and no director. That was always the ambition of the company, and that. You would do, for that company, you try to cut as little as possible, but you try to for everyone to, all those five actors to play all those parts. So it's very intriguing and very exciting from that point of view. I became very involved with that company, and going into somewhere like the Rose, where, as you said, there's not much space at all. You know, there's barely enough room for four actors, really, let alone 17 or however many you need if you did it properly. I loved the idea of exploring this epic quality, but with an intimate company. We started with a guy called Steve Gooch. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he does a thing called the Cut Shakespeare. I think he's worked with the RSC on lots of things, and he's very prolific. And his cut scripts tend to be pretty fabulous, actually. He offers you, it's a wonderful, if you get the opportunity to have a look, he writes the text down in bold, which he says is uncuttable, and then in very faint type, the bits that you can possibly lose.
So is this the folio he would be?
Yeah. And then, so we started as that, as our starting point, and then we sort of lost bits as we went. We did it as a company. I came up with the initial, I suppose, cut version, based on Steve Gooch's version of the cut video. And then as a company, we kind of created something around that. Mm. So some of it based on necessity or limitation, but some of it based on how going hand in hand with this idea of it being intimate and a chamber piece, that it could continue that feel of sort of a thriller and almost like an episode of CSI or Silent Witness, I think someone's described it as.
Well, the obvious thing to do to begin with, obviously, is to lose Fortinbras and that whole strand. So that's simple enough. Yeah. But you've lost Horatio as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
That's much braver.
Yeah. Well, It's interesting looking at the part of Horatio because, you know, and apologies to all actors who have ever been offered it or will ever get offered it in the future. But it is a pretty thankless role in terms of that
he's a listener.
He is, and he just says yes or no or agrees or disagrees with Hamlet. And so we thought, why don't we make that role the audience's role?
Yeah. Because
it's just a extension really of what they're doing anyway when Hamlet speaks to them in the monologue. So we create the audience as being Hamlet's best friend, which again helps with this feeling of intimacy.
Mm. Yes, the audience is definitely acknowledged, isn't it, throughout?
Very much, but
and involved just a little bit. I mean, not enough to frighten people. They don't have to
anything. No, we don't want to intimidate anyone. But you can't get away with it in the Rose, really, because the audience are on the stage pretty much all the time. So you can't ignore that they're there. So, yes, they become the players until Hamlet changes his mind and recasts the players with Claudius. They're Horatio. They're Hamlet's confidant. So when he's asking them to not reveal that he's putting on this antic disposition, then they're in on the secret.
Yes. Well, at least Jonathan Broadbent does get to play just Hamlet.
Yeah. So, I thought it'd be a bit much to ask him to play Third Lord from the left as well.
Well, he was your Romeo as well, I think, wasn't he? At the
No, he wasn't actually. He was Mercutio.
Oh, he was Mercutio. That's interesting.
Yeah.
But
amongst other things.
I'm sure he had to work hard. But Mercutio goes out so early on, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
But what qualities did you see in Jonathan Broadbent that you thought were suitable for Hamlet? I've only seen him playing with in Filter Companies, which is
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, in Midsummer Night's Dream. He's done more than that with them, I think, though, hasn't he?
Yes, he has.
But I saw him doing Midsummer Night's Dream fairly recently. Mm. Very, very joyous and funny production.
Yeah.
And he's obviously good at the humour. What else did you see in him?
Well, that's actually one of the reasons why I wanted him to cast him as Hamlet, because of the humour. He's a very old friend. Obviously, when you're directing Hamlet, one of the first things that you've got to be happy about is who plays Hamlet. I couldn't imagine doing it with anyone else. So as soon as I was offered the job for directing it, then I offered it to Johnny, who was very excited by it. He has this amazing ability to, even though he knows all about verse speaking and breath control and all of that that you've got to know about, he has this wonderful intimacy as an actor, I think, that he has a very open, honest face. And I'm sure that he'd forgive me for saying that he's a very un-Herculean man, in that he, you know, he's not tall and he's not dark and there's a slight feeling of, oh gosh, I don't know.
Well, he does look quite studenty, actually, with his specs and his concentration.
Yeah, there's a sort of Billy Bunterish quality to Johnny, which I adore, and I think that's a way in for the text and a way in for his for Hamlet's dilemma as well. So I purposely wanted someone who didn't look
like a matinee idol,
or brooding or unreachable, right. Or. Mm. Someone who would make the problem something other and untouchable. I wanted someone who was one of us, and I definitely think he is. So that's the main reason, really.
Mm. Well, he, as you say, does get just to play Hamlet, but everybody else, my goodness, has an awful lot to do. Mm. You have one woman in it, and she has to play both Gertrude and Ophelia, which is a lot, but you also have one actor playing Claudius and Polonius, which is quite difficult, isn't it? It gets a bit difficult.
Well, I hope he didn't look like it was difficult, but he has a lot of rushing about to do. Initially, I think he's the actor that has the most follow-on scenes as different characters. So he's running off stage as Claudius, and then he's got 2 seconds to get into Polonius. Actors love it because they get the opportunity to play different parts. I would imagine probably Paul, well, certainly in this stage of his career, would never be asked to play Polonius. I just think it's really interesting for a play that's all about, Well, not all about, because it's about many things, but there's such a lot about facade and seeming, yes, and showing and pretense and acting and theatre that we ran with that, really. And so therefore you're watching characters in a play, but you're also watching actors acting those characters in a play and how they solve that or potentially don't solve it. And I find that tremendously exciting.
Hmm. Yes, we should say who these people are. You mentioned Paul, and I thought, who's Paul?
Oh, sorry, that's his real name.
Oh, right.
Liam McKenna.
Right.
Not the hypnotist, Paul McKenna.
Okay, and then you've got Jamie Sheesby, who plays Laertes, Rosencrantz, Gravedigger, etc.
Yeah.
So he has a lot of moving about to do as well.
He does, yeah, but he's very young, so he can cope with it. He's got a very, very sponge-like brain, so he can cope with it.
And Suzanne Marie, who plays Ophelia and Gertrude, is experienced as a Rose actress, isn't she?
She does such a lot there.
Yes. We should say that they all wear coats nearly all the time, in fact, because... Yeah. But how, what was your thoughts about the costume? I mean, the costume is not your main. Well, obviously, it can't be too important because people are whizzing in as one person coming back as another.
Well, initially, it's because it's wintertime in Hamlet, yeah. So we wanted to reflect that. Our designer.
It is Denmark.
It's Denmark, yeah. It's by the coast, so there's obviously a wind whipping around the place. From a practical point of view, I didn't want any of our cast to go down with with the flu. So we thought we've got to wrap them up somehow. But yes, it's...
Well, you just wouldn't be able to go on if one of them got ill, presumably. You couldn't do it, could you?
We would, probably. I'd probably do it. So it's set in the wintertime. There's lots and lots of lines about the nipping cold, and we thought that was quite... pertinent that they should be experiencing the cold as perhaps the audience are as well. And also coats are a great way of covering up a body to make it look different from something else. So most of them will have a big coat for one of the characters and then much, much less as the other character. Yeah. So it enables quick changes and for an audience to invest in that.
Yes. Now, Suzanne Marie, who plays Ophelia, she comes in with an enormous length of knitting, bright red knitting, which she's doing this as a... She wants to give it to Hamlet.
Yes. Yes.
She's really doing this knitting, is she? Must have been going on for some time.
Well, my mother knitted it.
All right.
It's 20 feet long. We wanted to create the idea... Initially, it came from the idea of her sewing in her closet.
Yes.
And so we ran with that. The idea being that she's channeling her energy into something which represents her love of and her need for Hamlet. And obviously, she's not getting particularly a great deal back when the play starts from
Yes,
her.
She seems a fairly depressed sort of character, really, from the beginning, doesn't she?
Well, we thought
confused,
about... Yeah, well, when you think about Polonius's relationship with Laertes, which is... It feels terribly generous and terribly open and chummy, really, his relationship with Laertes. Yeah. And you just don't really get that with Polonius and Ophelia.
Yeah.
And this idea of a girl who doesn't have an older female figure in her life, is living in this court, which is... all about surveillance and things being done secretly, and that there really is no other person there for her, it seems, other than Hamlet, who once, in a moment of whatever it was, madness or pique or whatever, declared his undying love for her and then withdrew it. And that seemed to me a very poignant thing for her to have to live through, really.
And her relationship with her brother isn't chummy either, is it?
No, not at all. Well, he's on his way out, isn't he, at the beginning of the play, isn't he? He's off to foreign parts.
Yes. He's free and she isn't.
Yeah. So we've sort of explored the idea that she was the one being left, really, by pretty much all of the men in the play.
Mm. Mm. Yes, you have people dying and then another character who is the same, played by the same person, reporting the death. I mean, that's one case where Gertrude tells us about Ophelia's death, and she's just been Ophelia.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of. I hope that wasn't too confusing, but there's lots of resonances between Ophelia and Gertrude as well. I think in in that both of them have given of themselves to men who are unable to take that love, I suppose. So there's lots of links with the two women, and there's lots of contrasts as well with the other characters. And I just think it's fun for an audience to enjoy that.
You've had to change the order of things a little bit, haven't you, I think?
We have, yes. That wasn't absolutely about necessity, though. The play is a bit of a jumble. Am I allowed to say jumble? It's quite, you know, it's like To Be or Not To Be. It comes out of the most bonkers
place. Well, a lot of directors play, change where that's played, don't they?
And, of course, you know, it came from a pre-existing melodrama anyway. So the play's been fiddled about with in all sorts of ways. But yes, we've altered a few orders of the scenes around. Hopefully it works in terms of helps the thing motor through. It helps it have much more of a through line, with no disrespect to Mr. Shakespeare, of course, but mostly it was done for reasons of clarity, not to make our lives easier.
Well, it's remarkable, really, that you do manage to keep the tone, even with, you know, because you can imagine that it could start looking a bit funny with people thinking, oh, my God, I'm supposed to be somebody else now, and dashing it out. But the audience does accept that these people are who they say they are when they come in.
Well, if you play it with intention and seriousness, then that will be clear, I think.
Yes.
It's not sort of, you know, hat swapping and moustache swapping and anything like that, you know, which would have been a disaster.
Yes, it's not what's it called? The Shakespeare,
The reduced
Shakespeare. The reduced Shakespeare.
No, it's not. It's not. No.
Thank goodness. Well, having said you only have four actors, there's a little bit of help from another very well-known actor who comes on as the ghost, except he doesn't come on. He's on a radio. And now this radio is a terribly important prop, isn't it?
It is. It's scarily important. Yeah. It makes me sweat every time I'm watching it, praying that it works.
Right. So how's it set up?
I mean, well, it's by a Wi-Fi signal. So if you're technically inclined, a computer talks to our radio via a Wi-Fi signal.
Wow.
So someone's operating a computer off stage, you know, pressing play or go or whatever it is. And as long as you tune the radio into the appropriate channel and not Kiss FM or
Heart
FM, then it will play through the radio. Apparently that's how most... if you ever need a radio on stage, that's how it works these days, which was news to me. But...
How fascinating.
Well, someone did try and explain it to me in more detail than that, but my brain switched off and I couldn't cope. So that's as far as it goes, my technical knowledge.
But the very well-known actor is Simon Russell Beale, who is the ghost coming out of the radio. So you went and recorded him separately.
We did, he what a gentleman. We thought it would be rather lovely if a man who very famously and brilliantly played Hamlet could then play the ghost of Hamlet's father. So we very cheekily wrote him a letter, you know, not expecting him to reply even. And within the hour, actually, he said yes, that he'd be thrilled to. So we trotted along to his dressing room at the Noel Coward Theatre and...
Where he's in private on parade.
That's right. And... funnily enough, yes, he needed the text, but a lot of it he had his eyes off the text because, of course, he played Hamlet for...
He'd heard it so many
times. So he knew quite a lot of it. And it was a really great morning, actually, very humbling that he did it for us and did it so well. And he's a big supporter of the Rose as well, and thinks it's a magical place, which it is. So, yeah, we're really lucky that we've got him. We don't broadcast it very
it's
much.
It's not in the programme, I think, is it?
No. I think he's in the thank you list at the back, because we didn't want that to really sort of overshadow everything. We wanted to just be his voice.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But I suppose those that are in the know would recognise his voice.
Yes, or they'd think... Can't be.
Yes. Or perhaps we should put his name in the programme and then you wouldn't worry about it.
Oh, no, I thought, oh, that's Simon Russell Beale, and I thought, I bet he would do something like this,
Okay, right. Yeah. No, he's a very generous man.
Yes. But the radio comes in more than once, doesn't it? It's, because the ghost does.
Hamlet uses it for the mousetrap, the play of the mousetrap. It becomes his sort of little toy, really, the radio. We were looking at the idea of this very insular society, which happens within these very thick castle walls, or in our case, in a sort of bunker-type feel, underground. And perhaps Hamlet, having been to Wittenberg, having been outside, perhaps he's got a feeling of the idea. He has a knowledge of the outside world. So perhaps he listens to the World Service, in bed at night on his own, kind of wondering about what's out there and the world at large, whereas the other characters are perhaps much more looking in. So we wanted this idea of a man who had this companion almost in the radio.
Yeah. Well, the most unusual bit, I suppose, is the final scene where you have got a lot of characters on stage normally, and you've only got four people, all except one of them has to die. But you don't have swords and fighting, so explain how you set that up, because it's a game, isn't it?
Yes, we play the duel at the end, which is always a fencing match or a sword fight, as a poker game.
Yes.
Again, that comes
you
from...
have these little rows of...
Shot glasses. Yeah. Well, we started with the idea of having a chess game, and the chess pieces as being shot glasses. A bit James Bondy kind of thing. And then it did become a bit James Bondy, and we thought, no, that's a bit silly. Let's not do that. Again, it goes hand in hand with this feeling of intimacy and concentration, and that's a sort of forensic quality which surrounds the production, in terms of that things have to be very small. So a fencing match of the Rose would be quite dangerous because the audience is so close. There are also, from a banal point of view, there are all sorts of rules and regulations at the Rose in terms of stage blood and all that sort of proximity to the audience is one thing. Stage blood, because it's a national monument, you can't split stage blood. So from a banal point of view, we wanted to avoid that. But I also wanted this feeling of this sort of noirish, concentrated duel of minds at the end as well, and that has become a poker game where the forfeits, should you lose each round, is to take a shot of a shot glass which potentially may have poison in it. So it's very exciting, and audiences are absolutely silent, which surprises me, because, by then it's getting, the cold is setting in. But, and as I've said to the company, you really have to motor through the play in order to earn the silences at the end there, because there are quite a lot of pauses when we wonder if whoever's going to drink the next shot is going to keel over. And they have to earn those pauses in that space.
And so you can have the last word being... The rest is silence.
That's right, yes.
Which always sounds like the last line of the play anyway, but isn't, in fact, if you play the 14 plus bit. But anyway, that's and that's it. And then we just have... And everyone's already on stage to take the curtain call.
Yes. No flurry bustling, as Paul says. At the end, it's very clean. A very clean ending.
Well, I should imagine when you started this, you must have thought, no, I can't do this. This is impossible. But have you thought that you've actually got things out of it that you wouldn't have got out of doing a big production? Have you found things that you wouldn't have found?
Well, in fact, my first instinct wasn't, no, I can't do it. Because of my, I suppose, my involvement with actors from the London stage, because of the way that we did Romeo and Juliet.
Mm. How many did you have in there?
It was luxurious. We had 5.
Oh, right.
So I had a whole extra actor for that one. But no, this was purposefully 4 people for this one. We didn't want a 5th one. I have heard stuff in the play that I think I possibly wouldn't have heard had it been a bigger, louder, flurry-bustling production. Mm. I believe it in a way that I possibly wouldn't have with a bigger production. As I said about Johnny's quality in terms of just being able to communicate very well and very simply...
He seems quite at ease with the people being so close around him.
Yeah. Mm. No, he's a very experienced actor, but I enjoy the fact that when Hamlet talks to you, you can see his pupils in his eyes, and you can see the flush of his cheek, and you can see the sweat on his brow, and it makes it very intimate, it makes it very tender, it makes it very touching, I think.
And then when you have the people in the far distance, though, they're really very far away, aren't they? I mean, I know that's only little bits of it, really, but you've got the contrast.
You have, yeah.
With so you torches go from this, on their faces.
Yeah. So you go from this very intimate feeling to this very epic expanse of space that's beyond.
Yeah.
It can be very tricky, actually, directing that in the space. What you tend to have from a practical point of view, you need to have someone on stage with the audience whilst that is going on down there. Otherwise it can become a bit remote and a bit baggy and a bit lost, especially from having gone from something very concentrated and intense and intimate. You tend to sort of lose a little bit of concentration if something sort of very remote is happening over there. So we always plant an actor very near to the stage so that they're the filter by which you're watching down there. But it's also a relief as well that you get a little breather as an audience rather than an actor sort of breathing down your neck constantly. You get something which has a little bit more oxygen in it.
Yes, and it is actually quite exciting suddenly to see the whole space as well, just as the space.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, that was our intention.
Yeah. So would you be glad to do a big epic production? I mean, it hasn't put you off doing it in a different way.
No. Yeah. But you have to work with what you've got, don't you? You know, to put a big epic production in The Rose would sort of be silly.
But somewhere else.
And likewise, to do a 4-man Hamlet, a 3-man and 1-woman Hamlet in the Olivier would also be a bit perverse. So you have to... We were really keen that we exploit what The Rose has to offer. And it has to offer something very, this living room-esque feel to it.
Was there anything you really wished you could include which you had to leave out?
Well, our Rosencrantz and Guildenstern dilemma proved quite difficult to solve. I think we've done it in a slightly naughty way.
One of them is sort of off.
One of them's imagined. One of them is imagined.
But we imagine they're just behind us somewhere.
Well, or is it in Hamlet's imagination?
Oh, okay. Yes.
He tricks the rest of the family.
Oh, I see. Of course, he does do that.
Yes. Into thinking that Guildenstern exists, and they're slightly bemused by the idea of this invention. So, yes, we've solved that because, of course, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern come as a pair, don't they? And the other are never without each other. So we thought we've got to include them somehow.
People often make a joke about the Gertrude and Claudius mixing them up as well, don't they?
Yeah. There's that little line at the end of the scene, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, well, that doesn't seem to be too much to be a problem.
No. I wasn't disappointed to lose 15th Lord and 25th Norwegian
Horatio,
captain.
You might have minded about, but as you say, the audience becomes Horatio.
Yeah, and they enjoy that very much.
Some of Polonius, you could, you know, some of what he says, you could have had a bit more of, I suppose. But you don't mind not.
No. To be frank. And will the Rose also give you a recommendation that you don't go over 90 minutes because audiences get cold?
Yes.
And end up feeling quite sorry for themselves. And you know, if worse comes to the worst, leaving.
Yeah. And also, there's no loo.
There's no loo.
And when it's very cold outside.
Yeah. But the Globe are very nice to us. They let us wander around to them. So.
Oh, yes. I wondered if that was official. Mm.
So don't drink too much before you
come. Yeah, that's right. But... And anyone listening to this perhaps ought to know that the Rose is desperate for cash at the moment to develop its relationship with its audience. There's the Rose Revealed project going on, isn't there?
Well, they're very fortunate, I think, at the minute, because they've got a certain amount of money. I can't quite remember how much it is, but I think it's about 250,000, which the lottery have given them to re-excavate the site. Then, hopefully, I believe, and I hope I'm not getting this wrong, is that the next stage of it will be that they'll make another application to the lottery to actually completely redevelop the site. The intention is that, for anyone who hasn't been, imagine the Globe Theatre just being in ruins and it just being the foundation, so a circular space... Which at the moment
and
is
smaller. It's quite
and smaller. Yes, yeah, significantly smaller, and then covered in water to preserve it. So the idea is to re-excavate it, to put a glass lid on the top, which will in effect become a theatre in the round, and the glass lid will become the stage, and then to put the seating all the way around the outside. Mm. So London will, hopefully, fingers crossed, get another theatre in the round.
Well, it was discovered in 1989, wasn't it? And the office block did go ahead, although. Lots of us were marching up and down trying to stop this happening, but it did. And since then, two theatres have been found in North London, which they'll probably be treated rather better, I imagine.
Well, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? We were having this conversation the other day about if the Rose was found today, what the outcome would be. And one suspects it wouldn't be as brutal as it was in 1989.
Because there's even a possibility that some of what remains has deteriorated, hasn't there?
Well, yeah. They've done the best that they can.
Yes.
And they've done incredible work. They're amazing people there. They're all volunteers.
Yes, I know. People do work very hard for love of it. Yeah.
And they're very passionate about it.
Yes. Well, the Globe has lots of volunteers as well. I mean, that's how things are now. Anyway. Mm. So, well, thank you very much for talking about Hamlet and good luck with the next production.
Thank you very much.